This is a Cyber Union talk show for Monday, January 16th, 2012. The Tech Fifth International. Welcome to the show. My name is Steven in DF, or Mexico City. And with me, well, with me is actually not Walton. Well, it is Walton in one form. There is an interview that Walter did with Peter Waterman. And because we are getting crunched for time this month because of a couple outside of the Cyber Union's responsibilities, partly me traveling a bit in between Mexico and Guatemala, and Walton with some things going on that will be great to announce at some point, but I am not going to be the one announcing it, and I alluded to it again last week, but because Walton is not able to join us this week, I will again allude to something that I cannot say that he will share at some point when he's back on the show. In the meantime, I'm going to give a brief little update about things going on here with me before we get into the interview. It's a first part of a two-part series with Peter Waterman. It was a pretty long interview that was done, and it's really interesting as he gives some very good insight into labor unions and technology that was and is still a problem to this day. So I hope you'll enjoy it when we get to it, but I will first, of course, go into some updates on what's happening with me in this past week. I have actually traveled from San Marcos, Guatemala to DF, which is the federal district, or Mexico City, for those that don't know. And since I've been here, I've been warmly greeted and welcomed by Enrique from the May1st.org organization, or Primero de Mayo. And he's been really really helpful in getting me to understand a lot of things going on here in technology. And he has been involved in the past with La Neta, which has recently merged with May 1st. I'll let you look into those organizations on your own. I'll put some links in the show notes for you to look at. But I will say that I'm very happy to be a part, and I am also a member of May 1st, which is where our site will be moving to eventually. And I said this back in November, but because of my trip to Guatemala, it's been postponed a bit. So hopefully this coming week will be the week that we will actually get everything moved over directly to May 1st. And May 1st being a pretty really awesome organization, which I really do recommend, even though as a member I'm a bit biased, but we all have our own biases, of course. But in addition to that, the other things that I've been actually doing here since I've been in DF is actually visiting Occupy Mexico. And there are actually two locations. There's Occupy Meve, which is equivalent to the Wall Street of Mexico City. The other place that I plan to visit and will be doing so later this week is Occupy Coyoacán. And Coyoacán is near UNAM, which is the Autonomous University of Mexico, which if anybody is familiar, there's a lot of history with the university. It's been very radical over the years. It's also, I think, one of the largest universities in the world, somewhere around 300,000 students, which is just an amazing number to me. But there's a different Occupy location, and I think it's always good to have multiple occupations. It makes for a very interesting situation because you see how things get local wherever they are. Anyway, so I am actually going to be giving a talk with some of the people from Occupy BMV. They were excited actually to see somebody from Occupy Boston, which is where I originated from, I guess you could say. Though I had no intent of running into it the day I did. It was completely by chance. I was walking from the Zocalo, which is, I guess you could say, the square, the center park of the city. And I was heading down to eventually to a place where I was going to eat, and I just happened to run into their location. I was planning, of course, going later in the week, but I actually didn't know exactly where they were. So I ended up meeting up with a Donovan, who was very welcoming to explain what was going on there and the structures of how their things are going and when they have their general assemblies. And I'm hoping to attend one or two of them this week as they are on Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. And it was just kind of cool, actually kind of sharing a lot of information. He was not informed on a lot of the free software stuff. He's familiar with Ubuntu, but not the Free Software Foundation and May 1st and what they have been doing. And I explained a lot of the stuff that May 1st has been doing with Occupy Boston and other Occupy locations, giving server space and setting up emails and everything else, as well as being part of the community of Occupy. So there was a lot of cool information to relay there, and I had a really good time hanging out with them for a bit, even though my Spanish is still no perfecto. But I was able to communicate in English because a lot of them actually spoke English, or they actually understood it, though I was also explaining some things in Spanish as I've been practicing a bit more. So the other things that I've been active is thinking about ways of moving from Guatemala to here, because I've been quickly connected with a lot of different social movement organizations here and pretty excited about it. It's quite intriguing. And I have to say that Mexico City, I've said this to a couple of people that are close to me, is the first city I've ever been to outside of the country, but even inside the U.S., that kind of feels like home. Like, I don't feel out of place. I haven't had a single problem getting around the city. It's been very easy and very quick to adapt to, and it's a very eerie feeling, but I gotta say it honestly feels like home. And for somebody who like me, who grew up in the middle of farm country New Jersey, yes, it does exist. I never thought there would be a city that I could say that to. Even Boston, even living there for over 12 years, I mean, it feels like home in one sense, but not in the same sense that this place does. This DFA is just really intriguing to me, and maybe it's because it's such an older city. It just has some elements that I can't even describe that make it really intriguing. Anyhow, enough about my experiences here. We're going to skip over any tech-specific conversations, as there's a lot to go over in the interview with Peter. And as for updates for Walton, I will let him do that when he gets back to recording our show. So I hope you enjoy it.
Where did it come from? Where did the ideas come from? What was the initial impetus that led you to thinking about trade unions and technology and what it can mean? I'm personally quite interested in the global social movement unionism idea of it, and how have you seen that unfold? Some of the stuff that you wrote about in 92, for example, was really before anyone had done anything. It was mostly still theory at that stage. So what's happened since then? Have things met your expectations? Have they, ask some of those questions about that, and then also where you think things are going, and anything else you'd like to talk about as well.
Right. Well, I started really working on unions and ICT. This would have been about 1985 or something like that. And this was because I have a communications background, in the sense that my original training was as a journalist, and I'd worked as a journalist. And I wrote a piece entitled "Needed a New Communications Model for a New Labour Internationalism." And this actually dealt mm-hmm. with the different forms of communication, amongst which at that time, I suppose we would have been using email, and some of the international or internationalist worker support operations, like mm-hmm. In Hong Kong and UK and the Netherlands, were beginning to use computer communications. Mm-hmm. So in writing that first piece, actually I came across a book, a very American book, which was called, Networking or something. And I thought, well, the Americans are not always wrong. And although it was not a radical book, it was, kind of heavy breathing American type piece of work. but that word caught my mind. And I guess the next thing I did was the 1992 piece, which was called International Labour Communication by Computer, the Fifth International,
Towards the Fifth
question
International.
Mark. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. That's the first one that I came across, and I found that, that particularly interesting.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, that is the that is the kind of theoretical trigger for a lot of the discussions that
well,
came
well, this
subsequently.
Was a response to a conference organized by Dave Spooner and others who had been involved with the Asia Monitor Resource Center in Hong Kong,
mm-hmm.
and then with International Labour Reports, which was a monthly magazine or bi-monthly magazine, lasted for about 5 years in the UK. And I went to the conference and was both stimulated and shocked by some of the stuff going on, like trade unions, British trade unions, who said they didn't want to save their computer data. And when I asked why, they said they were afraid that the bosses would get hold of it and so on. And I said, if the bosses wanted to get hold of it, they've got hold of it. And then eventually mm-hmm. they said, well, actually, we don't want competing trade unions to get hold of it. And I should say before this, there was the earliest initiative was of this Norwegian guy who was trying to persuade the ICFTU to computerize, mm-hmm. And with a project called Unite, Unité in French. Spanish didn't mm-hmm. matter, and nobody thought about Russian or KwaZulu. And I met up with this guy, and you know, he had put a lot of energy into this, and there was a communications officer at the ICFTU at that time, and he was motivated. But despite their efforts, the ICFTU just said, no way, we're not interested.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see its value, and so on. So, and then through the 90s, I guess, I wrote a series of pieces. I did some research on, alternative international labor communication. I did a piece of research in Peru, and then one on the independent dock worker organization in Barcelona, which was part of mm-hmm. an international network. And this was not itself part of the international trade unions. Indeed, it was autonomous from any national trade union center in Spain. And they had I mean, we had in Holland at that time at my institute, we had desktop computers. They had a kind of desk bottom computer. It was a computer mm-hmm. as large as a desk. It was an IBM, which should by that time have been in a museum. But they were using this to more for their publications and maybe communications inside Spain, but they also did they were in communication with similar trade unions in other parts of Western Europe. As I said, a number of such projects. But I think during the 90s, things very much went up and down because shop floor internationalism of the 1980s, which was carried or sponsored or coordinated by Transnationals Information Exchange in London, and then by this magazine, International Labour Reports in Manchester originally, they kind of ran out of steam, ran out of money, and, you know, this was the height of neoliberalism and so on. And at the same time, the trade unions, I guess, began to very gradually, very slowly, and very awkwardly, I think, get into computer communications. But the kind of radical motivation of the 1980s
mm-hmm.
went into pretty much of a decline, and so I guess the next thing that would have happened would have been the book by Eric Lee. There mm-hmm. were various projects at that time in the UK. There was LabourNet UK, and this was a sort of grandiose project for LabourNet UK, your LabourNet Turkey, which actually still exists, LabourNet Italy, LabourNet, I don't know, Tierra del Fuego at the bottom of Latin America, and so on. But that collapsed due to the sort of rather vanguardist characteristics of the guy who initiated it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess after that, the next thing was Eric Lee's Labour Start. And he wrote this book on Labour and the Internet or something like that. A little book, which I provided a lot of material for from my files and so on. And then he set up Labour Start, which considered itself and considers itself a service to the international trade union movement. And the interesting thing about it is that it is not actually the property of the international trade union movement, which would not have been either interested or capable of doing this. But so it's an autonomous operation. It's basically an NGO. So I think that was the next kind of step, Labour Start still continues today, as you will know. And then a further step was much more recently. We're now talking about 2009 or 2010, when Eric started up Union Book.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the titles are wrong. It should have been Union Start and Labour Book, because because his first thing is I consider it a broadcasting operation. It collects information in, it sends information out, it sends out appeals for solidarity, and so on. But as I say, the model for me is a broadcasting model. And although
that's actually been one of your criticisms of the way a lot of unions have used technology in the past. I think I can't remember which paper it was, but I think that you did criticize that essentially a lot of union websites were online versions of the union magazine, and there wasn't really an attempt to use the technology to give people
That is correct, and that continues to be the case. And it's also actually the case with Labour Start in that it's not a dialogical site, okay? So now, then Eric set up Union Book, like, you know, Labour's answer to Facebook, and that's now been running for a couple of years. And it is actually, I think this comes under the heading of P2P, doesn't it? Person to person, insofar as he does not filter or edit or anything like that. So, I mean, he's just created this space, really, in which people can put up whatever they want. And you put it up, and it immediately appears. So, you know, that's actually that kind of model should be in operation by all national, international, local trade unions.
And interesting that it's had to come from outside the trade union movement, you know, outside of the official organizations.
It's a bit like radio initiative. What's it called? Radio Union, Union Radio, or he's a veteran. I mean, we met together in the probably in the 1980s already. But that also calls itself the radio broadcast of the international trade union movement. But again, although he may get support, Eric may probably get some support, and anyway recognition from the trade unions. But I'm still kind of waiting for Union Book to take off. I mean, there's a couple of us on there with our own ideas, and all credit to Eric, incidentally, for permitting us to put up stuff. He's really exercises maximum self-constraint, I would say. He's very rarely present on Union Book, and he's just sort of put it up and lets people get on with it.
I'm just going to do a quick aside to people listening who might not know what Union Book is. It's a social network for trade union activists based on a Ning platform, and I think it has around 5,000 users at the moment. So small compared to big fish like Facebook, but certainly useful to the people who do use it. But I think, as Peter says, it's not reached any kind of critical mass. And if I would hazard a guess at why, it's probably because to use it, you have to be both very interested in social networks and in trade unions. And there's probably a relatively small pool of people who are in that state. Another question. I mean, obviously, you will be aware of the role that technology has supposedly played in some of the uprisings which we've seen over the past few years, the Arab Spring and lots of other things. And the extent, I don't know if anyone's actually done very conclusive research into how much technology was actually used, because there might be a bit of a difference between media hype around Twitter and Facebook revolutions and how people were actually using technology. It's certainly likely that a lot of people were using text message rather than Twitter, for example. But nonetheless, that seems to all have been peer-to-peer communication, not things which came from official organizations. Do you think that there's a tension between ordinary union members and the official union organization? And do you think that as new communications technology gets more user-friendly and more people have access to it, that the grassroots or rank-and-file networks within trade unions will find communicating with each other a lot easier and essentially bring about a new kind of trade unionism that's a lot more democratic and member-controlled?
I think this will eventually happen, and however, I think that most of the people you mentioned who are interested both in the communications technology or competent at a minimal level, and union oriented, that they're using Facebook.
I think you're right. A lot of people
And
use
there have,
Facebook.
of course, been various movements, labor protest movements, which have, in one way or another, been internet dependent. As well as activities or, sabotage activities, but you probably know more about those than I do. If we go back to where you started with the Arab Spring and so on, there's certainly a lot of hype, but I thought interesting what somebody said about the combination of high technology and the popular movements, so because the popular movements, or what is called the Arab Street, exists at a very low level of technology, and whilst one wonders how many people in Cairo or in Helwan Industrial Center or somewhere else, how many workers or even clerks would have cell phones. That's one thing, and the other thing is, what is the penetration of internet cafes and so on? Because in Lima, this is high. Both things are high. That is, that there's a quite a high level of cell phone use, celulares, amongst the sectores populares, the popular sectors. So in the markets, you see these, and people are using them. And the other thing is, there's a very widespread of internet cafes. So in Lima, you wouldn't have to walk a couple of blocks in any direction to come across a cyber cafe. However, I would say it's very early days for talking about cyber connected or cyber inspired or coordinated labor protest movements. More so than the more general ones, because I think that the that that ICT did play a role in the Arab Spring, and we can't say this is true of the trade unions, and this is because when we're talking about trade unions, we're talking about a form of worker self-articulation. Which goes back, well, at least 150 years. There's the, you're recruited into the union, or you apply to join the union, and you go to a union meeting, and you have a membership card, and you have certain rights or responsibilities, and so on. But the structure, in general, is that is of a pyramid. So this is a hierarchical institutional structure, which is in always been in great tension with social protest and social movement, and it's very difficult for the unions to reinvent themselves for the information age. So I think the incentive for this, it comes from the base all around the unions, or from, you know, now from the other social movements. And this goes for, this is communication in general. I mean, the trade unions are not good at communication. And they think they've certainly improved over the period I've been writing about this, but they're not really communication savvy. I mean, the films and the cartoons and the newspapers and the posters, you know, if you compare trade union art with that of what has come up out of the Occupy movement, you know, you just look at the posters of the Occupy movement on the web, and you'll see what imagination, and even the slogans. Yeah, when did the trade unions have a slogan like, I mean, like the 99%?
I know. Yeah, that's it. I mean, just from a pure marketing perspective, that's branding genius, isn't it? I mean, if you had to pay a consultancy to come up with the 99%, you'd be paying thousands and thousands for it, I think.
Well, they would pay. Yeah. They have paid, and what they get from the consultants is shit.
It's true. Yes, I've seen some of the
American
the rebranding
unions,
exercises that unions have been through, and
because the U.S. unions, the AFL-CIO, of course, have a problem. Well, pay somebody enormous amounts of money for a consultation, you know? And so you know, whereas I mean, the union newspaper or the Labour or the socialist newspaper, you know, and for that matter, whole cultural movement existed round about 1900. You know, that just got kind of disappeared, faded away. I mean, there were worker film, photos, sport, theatre, everything kind of movements at that time and later, and then these just got kind of wiped out or marginalized. So
a culture like that acts as a I suppose a repository for a struggle, and also for it gives resilience to it. And that's part of the reason I think that trade unions have a really difficult time, is they have nothing to draw on. They have no resources. They have no cultural background. They have no community to go back to. They have no ecosystem of political activism. And they find themselves very easily isolated and very easily outflanked by right-wing media. So what is to be done?
As I say, you see, it's not simply that this is a resource, but I thought we need, you know, I've thought for a long time we needed to move from an institutional internationalism to a communication internationalism, you know, which communication is, it's not simply an instrument. But it is actually, it is the message, you know, the medium here is the message. The message is network. And this is how, of course, the whole Occupy movement has developed. And, there are various people who talk about, Richard Hyman, now retired, major theorist of British trade unions and labour relations, who ended a piece he wrote forward to the networked trade union of the future, you know. And I think that there are various labour-related movements which are not unions, and which anyway at the international level, you know, they have no alternative but to use information and communication technology. And but w whether you know, what shape, what new shape the trade unions have to take, and they do have to take a new shape, because we're living under a globalized and informatized capitalism, and we've had revolutions inside capitalism, and the revolutions inside capitalism are with us, whereas the revolutions against capitalism, as we know, they got they've been reincorporated into capitalism.
Help will come whenever it's needed. Cheer, my comrades, cheer.
And that was a really good section there. And we split the interview up into two parts, as I think I said earlier, because there could segmental breaks, but we also didn't want to leave you all with an extensive interview, especially one that's very detailed and comprehensive. So we will continue this show in the near future. We will announce when we will put the second segment on. But I hope you enjoyed it, and we will all see you next week.